From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get the latest on Hurricane Dorian, which has weakened to a Category 2 storm, but still remains dangerous. Powerful winds and storm surge from Dorian are expected to continue to threaten Grand Bahama Island today, and parts of Florida are starting to feel Dorian's effects as it moves to the northwest. Joining us now is Ray Hawthorne, a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. He's in Gainesville, Florida. Hi, Ray.
Hi there, Jeremy.
So first of all, Dorian is currently moving slower than we can walk right now, about 2 miles per hour. What is it doing exactly? Give us the latest.
Yeah, the latest from the Hurricane Center has it at top sustained winds of 110 miles per hour. It is a Category 2 hurricane at the moment. It is moving toward the northwest at double the speed that it was about 3 hours ago, but that's not saying all that much, Jeremy. It's moving northwest at 2 miles per hour. It will begin to accelerate a little bit later on today, but don't get your hopes up. The motion is still going to be very slow toward the northwest and the north-northwest.
And what is the path at this point? When you say to the west and north-northwest, we're talking about basically skirting up along the east coast of the United States.
Yeah, so the core of the hurricane itself is likely to remain just offshore Florida today all the way through tomorrow. However, the storm is large enough where tropical storm force winds are a very good bet along the Florida Atlantic coast. In fact, that's already been happening this morning, and that will continue. We could even see some hurricane force wind gusts, especially out over the Cape and Brevard County. And then the storm, after it moves past Florida, will start to head in the direction of the Carolinas. And in fact, some of the strongest winds with this storm could in fact be over south or North Carolina coming up on Thursday.
How confident are you at this point that there won't be a landfall in the U.S.?
Well, it's unlikely that the hurricane will make landfall in Florida. It's slightly more likely in South or North Carolina, but still the odds are somewhat against a landfall, even in the Carolinas. So there still could be a slight deviation to the west that would bring the core of the hurricane on into the Carolinas. But right now, the official forecast, keeping it just offshore, but unfortunately not far enough offshore to prevent tropical storm and hurricane force conditions.
So what would you tell our listeners along the coast of Florida, Georgia, South, and North Carolina as they watch this powerful storm at least come close by?
Well, the first thing is don't be fooled. Yes, this was a Category 5 hurricane just a couple of days ago. It's a Category 2 now. That almost doesn't matter. The impacts are likely to be exactly the same. We're still expecting a storm surge of 4 to 7 feet. We're still expecting coastal flooding. We've had days of easterly wind out ahead of the hurricane, so that is still a likelihood over the coast of the east coast of Florida. And then for South Carolina, same thing. And in fact, in South Carolina and North Carolina, it looks like the threat of heavier rainfall is more likely there. We're looking at 5 to 10 inches of rainfall, isolated amounts up to 15 inches along the South Carolina coast. And those areas, too, will have the threat for coastal flooding. Charleston has just had quite a bit of coastal flooding with king tides over the last couple of weeks.
And Ray, let's just talk for a moment about what's been going on in the Bahamas. A Category 5 storm is what it was, just stopped over the Bahamas and sat there and pummeled the islands there for more than 24 hours.
So a Category 5 hurricane, Jeremy, is much like an EF3 or an EF4 tornado. Imagine that those sorts of winds just sitting over the exact same places for 24, 30, 36 hours. Those areas, I've seen some of the video there, the devastation is incredible. And I'm sure we're going to see more of that in the coming days. Just a really horrific situation in the Bahamas. I can't even imagine.
Have you ever seen a storm in the ocean? Because basically, I mean, the islands aren't that big right there. It's basically in the ocean. Just stop like that.
Yeah, there have been many storms that have stopped. But in this case, I can't off the top of my head remember a Category 5 hurricane or a strong Category 4 hurricane just come to a complete stop right over the Bahamas. That I cannot recall.
That is Ray Hawthorne, who's a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, as we continue to monitor Hurricane Dorian, now a Category 2 storm. Ray, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Let's get an update now on what's being called the worst maritime disaster in recent California history. It's assumed most of the people sleeping below decks on that scuba diving boat anchored off of Santa Cruz Island off the Southern California coast died in that massive fire. 5 crew members who might have been above deck swam to a nearby fishing boat. The charter boat Conception caught fire early Monday morning and then sank. Saul Gonzalez is co-host of the California Report on KQED. He's in Santa Barbara, which was the home port of the Conception. Saul, we understand bodies are being returned there. What are you seeing?
Well, search and I guess you can't say it's really search and rescue operations anymore. I think authorities are pretty much fully into recovery of human remains, and they found more than 24 so far. Again, keep in mind there were 39 people aboard this vessel, five survivors, all of them crew members. That leaves 34 people, and it looks like they all perished.
Yeah, just terrible. Do we know any more about what happened? We had that distress call that the Coast Guard got, an unidentified man saying, you know, people are trapped, mayday, mayday, he can't breathe. They tried to reach back to him, couldn't. Do we know how this terrible fire started?
No, we do not know. There's been some supposition that it could have been a fuel line or a spark that set it off. I mean, keep in mind, though, the conditions. The sheriff of Santa Barbara County yesterday said, you know, this was the worst possible scenario to happen. A fire aboard a vessel at any time could be very, very hazardous. You add to that, it's the middle of the night, 3:15, 3:30 in the morning. Cabins that are packed full of people, they're unfamiliar with the boat. So you add that all up, and it is just a recipe for a catastrophe like the one that we had. There were reports, though, Robin, of smaller explosions, and it's thought those were oxygen tanks being set off and essentially becoming mini explosives themselves.
Because, again, this was a scuba diving trip, a three-day scuba diving trip, so the oxygen tanks, and we, you know, if you're familiar with boats, you know that there's usually just one ladder that comes up from the bottom of the boat to the top, and if these explosions or fire were at that one ladder, if that was the case, I mean, it's just hard to imagine how people would get out. And there's talk that this might spur some kind of move to change the design of boats to make sure that there are escape hatches. Are people already talking about that?
Well, yes. Senator Feinstein, the U.S. Senator from California, has called for an investigation. I'm sure authorities will be looking into that. Although, keep in mind, according to the Coast Guard, I mean, this vessel was up to snuff. It had gone through inspections, I believe, in February. It had safety equipment aboard, including fire extinguishers. So, according to the Coast Guard, there was nothing ostensibly wrong with this vessel at all. And I talked to a man yesterday who had been aboard this vessel as a scuba diver himself, and he said the crew was very professional and the boat seemed to be in really, really good condition. Now, in terms of wider changes beyond that, I think that'll be a conversation we'll have in the coming days or weeks or months. But, you know, I'm standing looking out over Santa Barbara Harbor right now, and they're just, you know, a lot of these kind of vessels here in the harbor, a lot of them make these runs out to the Channel Islands. So that would require a significant amount of retrofitting of a lot of boats that are already in the water.
Do we know any more about the passengers?
They were all scuba divers to some degree, of course, because they were on this trip to explore the coast of Santa Cruz Island, which is the largest of an island chain off the coast of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Apparently, many of them came from further north up the coast, up toward the Monterey area of California. They chartered this for a three-day expedition, and no, not a lot is known about the passengers. Apparently, there was a married couple aboard with their teenage child that went on this family trip, but we're just getting news of just who exactly was aboard this vessel. Although I should say the company that ran it is very well known here in Santa Barbara, that owned the boat. They've been in operation since the mid-1970s and been, you know, seen as a pretty good corporate citizen here in the waterfront in Santa Barbara.
Well, yeah, what are you hearing from people there in Santa Barbara?
Well, it's shock. I mean, I can't think, you know, I'm a native Southern Californian. I cannot think of a disaster like this, a maritime disaster in recent years in all of California waters. And it's just so unusual. And I think everybody's just reeling from just how strange this accident was, this catastrophe was. And I think local officials now have to struggle with the aftermath, and that is, you know, the local coroner's office apparently is stretched thin. So the coroner's asked for assistance from Los Angeles, the city of LA, the county of LA, and Sacramento to get some additional coroner help in. And then the other big challenge, Robin, is what to do with this vessel now, right? It's sitting in about over 60 feet of water, and do they continue to sort of keep it on site for a while and look for more human remains, or do they try to tow it in pretty soon? And when it comes into the mainland, it'll likely come into where I am, Santa Barbara, or to Ventura, which is just south of here.
Again, it's about 20 yards off the island of Santa Cruz, the Channel Island that is just so popular and beautiful. That site of it being towed and brought into Santa Barbara, that is going to be if that happens, that will be heartbreaking.
Yes, it will be. And I should say that there, you know, this is a time of year where a lot of people are going to and from these islands. They're very rustic islands, largely uninhabited, and very popular with scuba divers, hikers, and kayakers.
Yeah. Saul Gonzalez, again, co-host of the California Report on KQED, there in Santa Barbara, the home port for the now submerged Conception. Saul, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
There's a new book out today about the rise of the ride-hailing app Uber and the dramatic fall of its founder, Travis Kalanick. It's called Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, and its author, New York Times technology reporter Mike Isaac, joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And first of all, let's just set the scene here. Uber started when? Back in 2009?
Nine, yes, that's right.
But it wasn't called Uber at the time.
Yeah, the first iteration of Uber was actually called Uber Cab, and if you lived in San Francisco or can even remember that far back, it was basically a black car service only for folks who were willing to pay a premium to get carted around in San Francisco.
Okay, and so that was then, and now Uber is worth how much money?
Now, I would say the tens of billions of dollars at its highest valuation when it was private. Upwards of $60 billion. That's a little lower now because they've taken a hit on the market, but it is quite a bit bigger now than it was when it was just a small black car service.
Okay, and all around the world now.
That's right.
Now, your book opens with a battle between Uber and city officials in Portland, Oregon. It was one of the many cities that Uber barged into before local officials could react, and it's kind of a case study in how Uber operated. Tell us what happened in Portland.
Yeah. So now Uber's so ubiquitous, it's hard to remember for some back when it was actually not legal to operate in many of these cities, right? So part of Uber's playbook from the very beginning was to take this service it had called UberX, which is essentially a way to sign up anyone to with a car and a background check to drive for Uber, and push into new cities over and over in states across the United States and then in new countries around the world. Sometimes they would face pushback from the local government. And in this case in Portland, what they had a problem with was a mandate from transportation officials saying, if you come into this city, we will shut you down. We will impound your cars. We don't want Uber here yet.
Mm-hmm.
So Uber, being Uber, wasn't going to take that lying down, and they had devised this piece of code called Grayball, was the code name internally. What it essentially did was tagged the apps of official transportation officers, even police officers, and used this code to kind of like hide Uber from these officers.
So that when they would request a car, for example, it would just cancel on them before it got to them so they couldn't ticket the driver.
Yeah. And if you were a transportation official, it would look like the service was too busy or whatever. But in reality, Uber had sort of spotted them and tried to shut the app down before they could ever capture them.
And did that work?
It did. There were a lot of questions about its legality years later when we uncovered it. But they did that in a number of cities, and it kept the cops and transportation officials off their back, and it seemed to really work.
And it brings up the idea that Uber also had to, in every single place that it went, be really local about how it got itself in there. And you write, it was as if Kalanick had hired a private army of mini entrepreneurs and given them one mandate, conquer. Everyone was a founder of their own city-level fiefdom. Everyone got to live the startup hacker ethos, something Kalanick cherished and never wanted his company to lose, even as Uber spread like wildfire. With a slap on the back, Kalanick would send his officers out into the field to build their own infantry and fight for Uber.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. All over the world he did that.
I mean, there's sort of a dual brilliance and some drawbacks of this method. But Kalanick, he's a startup guy from the beginning, a serial entrepreneur, and really cherished this small company spirit and wanted to empower every new general manager in cities across the world to sort of take control of how they ran their local office. And the positive part of that is that, well, maybe someone who's from Miami might know how to build local operations in that city much better than, say, someone back in San Francisco headquarters. Mm-hmm. But the drawbacks of that is if you sort of empower this army of bros to kind of take over each city and do what they want, sometimes you can have some really negative consequences. And one of those was Grayball, and another one was, you know, spending millions of dollars without really any oversight from the main office, or all sorts of sort of bad behaviors that came out later on.
Well, and let's talk also about the fact that in some cases, Uber officials were bribing authorities to look the other way.
Yeah, I mean, in some of the markets in Southeast Asia, they started setting up these what are called green light hubs, little places where drivers can stop in, sort of maintain their vehicles, get checked in suburban areas. And this was not welcome or really legal in the area. So company employees started paying off local police officers in order to help them like move traffic through the areas. And that is another sort of detail that was obviously illegal, but then came out later on in a deep investigation of the company. And now it's a question of whether they broke the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, basically. Mm-hmm.
There was also violence in many places, including India.
Yeah, you know, the real the story of Uber is really about parachuting into these areas, some of which may have like difficult economic or regional cultural issues going on, and then just sort of introducing this new transportation method, new business very quickly. And so in Brazil, they were in the depth of a recession and sort of real deep unemployment issues, and Uber came into the country and got up and running very fast. But also a bunch of drivers were murdered because of it was largely cash-based, and drivers kept carrying cash on them as they picked up people. And so they were basically like rolling ATMs that robbers would go after and sort of pick them off. Or in India, for instance, there was just like real unrest around how they treated drivers. And it was hard for drivers to feel really like it was a reliable source of income and service.
I want to also ask you about China, because you talk about Kalanick's sort of obsession with getting into the China market, which has been so hard for Western tech companies to break into. And he threw a lot of money at that, and they scammed him badly.
Yeah, you know, China is this sort of jewel that every Western CEO has always wanted to conquer, especially tech company software CEOs. Google has had its many different sort of attempts to break into China, still trying to right now. And so Travis Kalanick thought he had cracked it. You know, he was going to court the officials. He was going to really spend as much money as he can subsidizing free rides. Now, the problem was that an entire crime syndicate sort of sprung up and started creating many sort of fake ride attempts to scam Uber out of what turned out to be tens of millions of dollars. And ultimately, half of all rides in some cities at one point were completely fake. And that money was just going into the pockets of scammers. But the thinking by Travis and others at the time was, we just keep spending, keep subsidizing this, and eventually we'll get into the country. And ultimately, that didn't work out.
Okay, so there have been obviously ups and downs in Uber's rise. But overall, can you think of any other company that has had comparable growth over such a short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, the popular phrase out in the Valley is that Uber was the fastest growing startup in Silicon Valley history. And I don't think you can really challenge that. This company had what some people called the perfect product market fit. You know, there were cities that didn't have great transportation systems. I remember living in San Francisco in 2008. You'd have to call a cab and just pray that it would come,
right,
whether it did or not. And so I do think that they really did change the world in how they provided transportation where it wasn't before. Now, you have to just wonder whether some of the other unintended side effects, you know, whether it's crumbling infrastructure of public transportation or changing how some cities operate and increasing traffic, like if those are worth the innovation that the company has brought with it.
Do you think Uber is here to stay as it is right now? Or do you think that there's a chance that somebody else could come along? I mean, it could be Lyft or somebody else or some other kind of transportation and knock them out.
Yeah, I think that's the real sort of irony of Uber, is that they really pioneered the category of ride hailing and ride sharing, but they might not be the ultimate winner of ride hailing and ride sharing. You know, you have to give them credit that they popularized the service. It's now ubiquitous in most countries around the world, but, you know, it might not have a business model that works out for them. They might be losing too much money. They lost, you know, more than $5 billion a few weeks ago in their quarterly earnings report. So even though we can credit them with the rise of ride sharing, it'll be interesting to see if they are the ultimate winners in the category.
Why haven't they been able to make money?
Well, you know, things have really changed over the past few years from, say, 2009 when Uber was up and running. In the beginning, they were really one of the dominant players in town, both in the U.S. and abroad. And Kalanick's obsession was just with raising money. Like, I would say every few months, they would raise a new round of venture capital starting around 2014. And they ultimately raised like billions, more than $10 billion in private funding to sort of keep this growth engine going. What happened was the funding environment changed, and now competitors in India and Southeast Asia, in South America and China, they were all able to raise equally large amounts of money. And now instead of Uber just sort of spending to grow in the United States, it's burning cash on multiple continents across dozens of countries, fighting competitors everywhere. And that just is hard to grow a business if you're just constantly burning money to break above even in market share.
That is Mike Isaac, technology reporter for The New York Times. His new book out today is called Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber. Our conversation continues tomorrow. We'll hear more about how founder Travis Kalanick unraveled and what Uber's lasting impact might be. You can find an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
Stocks open lower today, reflecting nervousness over the latest round of tariffs. President Trump imposing a 15% tariff or tax on more than $100 billion worth of Chinese imports, the Chinese retaliating with duties on American goods. And there'll be another round of tariffs by both countries come December. And then there's Brexit. Will lawmakers be able to block Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to leave the European Union without a deal? As breaths are held there, the sterling fell to its lowest in nearly 3 years. Joining us now, WBUR business reporter Callum Borges. Hi, Callum.
Hi, Robin.
So the long-running trade war intensifying, even as the two sides, China and the U.S., are supposed to meet this month for negotiations. The president tweeting out, "We're doing very well in our negotiations with China," later tweeting out, "Think what happens to China when I win," meaning the 2020 election. "Deal would get much tougher. In the meantime, China's supply chain will crumble and businesses, jobs, and money will be gone." I'm not making fun. These are the capital caps that I'm trying to express here. And you know, some would say, is that how you talk before negotiations, that it might be going on through 2020? I mean, your sense of how investors are reading that.
Well, investors are clearly nervous because you see the markets, as you mentioned, Robin, opening down this morning, and not just in the U.S. And as far as these tariffs and how they're affecting American consumers and companies, I mean, the businesses are already feeling it. You know, they're seeing their supplies go up. We're learning today, for example, that in the manufacturing sector, factory orders, employment, production all declined in August, which was the first month of contraction in 3 years. The customers have been somewhat spared, Robin, because businesses are trying to hold the line on prices. The thinking being, you know, if we can sort of absorb lower profits for now, we won't turn off those customers by hiking prices on them. But that's not sustainable forever, obviously. Right. And the president is clearly looking ahead to you know, beyond the 2020 election in the second term.
Right. And if there's a ripple effect, if a company says, you know what, maybe we don't open that factory and buy those thingamajigs because we don't know what's going to happen, then the people who sell the thingamajigs get hurt and it just has repercussions there.
That's right.
China's tariffs will hit American farmers hard. They've imposed tariffs on products like soybeans, corn again. So how is that reverberating?
Yeah, it's struggling. I mean, the soybeans you mentioned are the United States' number one agricultural export, and China's the number one customer. And soybean exports to China in the first half of this year, Robin, were at their lowest level since 2002. Now, remember, the Trump administration has announced two rounds of relief packages for farmers, totaling $28 billion. But most of that money hasn't been dispersed yet. And there's so many farms filing claims that the pieces aren't very big in many cases. I mean, the average payout for the bottom 80% of farms is only about $5,000, according to the Environmental Working Group.
And it's not just the farmers. DeMonte Foods recently said it's closing U.S. plants and laying off workers. in part to cut the cost. The British pound slipping as that crisis surrounding Brexit continues. A cross-party group of members of parliament want to try to seize control of parliament, even though Johnson wants to suspend it. He wants the Brexit no deal. They don't. But investors reacting there as well.
They are. I mean, selfishly, Robin, I wish the pound was this favorable for Americans when I was studying abroad in London. I mean, it's down to about $1.20, the exchange rate. That's 27 cents less than it was before the Brexit referendum. And you see the markets responding. I mean, the yield on the 10-year note in Britain is very low. Markets are trading down in the U.S., France, Germany, South Korea, all down today. Hard to isolate any single factor, but clearly not knowing what the business relationship between Britain and the rest of Europe is going to be after November is really unsettling for investors.
Sure, sure. And it's being felt around the world. BUR's business reporter, Callum Borgers. Callum, thank you as always.
Glad to be with you.
Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro is facing criticism today because, according to an aide, he's going to miss a summit on the forest fires tearing through the Amazon right now. He will be preparing for surgery. Under Bolsonaro's watch, there has been an 80% increase in fires this year in the Amazon, many intentionally set to clear land for other uses. But the Amazon is not the only forest in trouble. Mark Cochran is a professor at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. He's an expert in tropical forests and joins us now. Professor, the Amazon is not the only big forest that people consider to be part of the lungs of the planet. There are other forests, even in Brazil, that have been deforested.
Yeah, that's correct. You get the Atlantic rainforest, which is all along the coastline of Brazil, and about 85% of that has already been deforested, and the rest is largely fragmented. The other world's tropical forests are under threat as well. Southeast Asia's faced extensive logging and conversion to oil palm. Africa's had longstanding deforestation that people don't even remember anymore, since much of it has happened already. And then we have the rest of the world's forests, where we have either cut or are cutting. The United States has largely cut all of its forests, and many have grown back or are growing back. Europe, their ancient forests are largely gone and have been replaced with agriculture. And we're seeing increasing numbers of fires now in the boreal forest of both Canada and Russia.
So do you think it's unfair then that there's so much attention being put on what Brazil is allowing to happen to its forests?
Yeah, I don't know if you call it unfair. It's certainly the Western countries have no moral high ground from which to criticize Brazil. That doesn't change the fact that Brazil is experiencing extensive fires, and even the Brazilian people do not accept the changes in the environmental laws that have been enforced in recent years. So it's not just the external world criticizing Bolsonaro and the government, but also many within Brazil itself.
Let's talk about some of the forests you just mentioned, starting with Europe. What existed there and how much is left and why is it gone?
Yeah. Much of Europe used to be forested, whether it was out to England or all across Germany. When the Romans came through, they fought in the forests of Germany. Much of that has now been lost. The last of the remaining old growth, I believe, is in Poland, and even that is under threat now. So much of the European forest has long ago been cut.
And what about the United States? There are obviously a lot of forests in the United States, but almost none of them are virgin forests, right?
Correct. Yeah, it used to be that almost everything east of the Mississippi was forested in the U.S., and then we had all of our large forests in the western U.S., and much of that has been logged over at least once. Now, in the eastern U.S., much of it has been regrowing over recent decades because as we opened agriculture in the Midwest, we abandoned a lot of farmlands in the east. So the U.S. actually gains carbon credits because of a regrowing forest that we had cut, you know, a century ago.
Is there a difference, though, between the forest that existed in the U.S. or in Europe and such a unique ecosystem that exists in the Amazon?
Oh, yeah, there are differences in the sense primarily of the diversity. The tropical forests have many more species, orders of magnitude more species than all of North America or Europe, for example. So they are ancient and very diverse. The forests here used to be very old as well, or many of them, but they're more acclimated to disturbances such as fire, versus the tropical forest, which have had no evolutionary adaptation to fire because there is literally no natural fire in those systems.
In terms of other tropical forests, you mentioned Indonesia. I know you're going to be going to Indonesia soon to look at the forest there. They're being burned, as you said, to clear the way for palm oil trees. Give us a sense of what's happening there.
Yeah, so in Indonesia and much of Southeast Asia, they've been clearing first for logging purposes, but in the peat swamps, they've cleared them and drained them, and they are converting many of these areas to oil palm. The problem there is, although oil palm produces, you know, products we want, burning in those areas not only removes the native forest, it actually burns into the organic-rich soils themselves and starts consuming those and releases huge amounts of emissions of both greenhouse gases and particulates, such that in 2015, the last El Nino, we had such large fires it impacted all the way out to Singapore and Malaysia. Estimates are that 100,000 people are dying from that smoke.
What about in Africa? Some massive fires going on in the tropical forests of Africa.
Every year, Africa has massive fires more than anywhere else on the planet. And if you look at the products we have for looking at fire, you can see it sweeping up and down through Africa every year. So that is not necessarily unusual. What would be unusual is if it is burning into the remaining forests.
Is there any place on Earth where a country is really handling its natural forests well?
That's a good question. Not that I know of. They're trying. I mean, some places are less skewed. So some place like Canada, where huge areas of it are so rural that they don't try to manage it. So they have systems that are largely intact, or Russia with Siberia, but those areas, climate change may be shifting how fires are burning and creating other types of problems. Places like the U.S., we have huge resources. We have tried to control fire for decades. We're spending many more dollars trying to do something, and we're over billions every year, and yet we're having more area burned, and especially in large fires. So even trying to throw a lot of resources at it is not controlling the problem.
But I think one of the things that is surprising to many as they've watched what's been happening in the Amazon is that it's not, you know, a wildfire that is just naturally occurring in the forest. It's somebody setting the forest on fire so that they can clear the land, often for cattle. And the experts will say that that's not even a good place to raise cattle anyway.
Yeah, well, it depends how you look at these things. One is, yes, it is like you say, we initiate fires in that manner. Cattle is good for people in Brazil because it's economically stable. It's not good in terms of the amount of beef you can raise per hectare. But for them economically, it makes a lot of sense. In terms of the fires themselves, they are set to either deforest an area, like you say, so they ignite that, or to keep pastures and other areas clear of fire. But many of those fires then escape any kind of control and then continue across that landscape, either through damaged forests or in extreme years through the actual standing intact forests. So what starts as intentional fire often becomes accidental fire.
Do you see a solution to this, to try to protect some of the remaining forests and tropical forests that exist in the world?
Well, Brazil had made a really good start on this over the last couple decades. They protected more than half of the forest from deforestation, and they don't get much credit for all of those efforts. They've also been working to legalize the tenure on the land and been enforcing the laws for when you can convert, when you can burn, and such that the amount of deforestation from 2004 until recent years had dropped dramatically from about 25,000 square kilometers a year to 7,000 square kilometers a year. Only in the last year or two has it started going back up, and that is why there is concern this year, because it's effectively gone up by about 80% so far. The chances to try to control this are, one, protecting large areas, but two, trying to manage that land ideally without fire when possible, or when using fire to do it more professionally, shall we say. You don't burn into a standing forest, you burn away from it towards the center. You burn areas when the ambient conditions are not conducive to wildfire spread. Mm-hmm. You know, you ideally have areas that are managed the same way, so you don't try to put, say, fruit trees next to a pasture where you're going to be burning. You also try not to overly fragment the forest area where you are having fire, because once you fragment that and kind of chop it up into pieces, it bleeds the moisture out and it becomes easier to burn. So you have to be more proactive if you're going to do this. And ideally, if we can move towards other land uses that are not so fire dependent, that would help as well.
You've been to the forests in the Amazon that are facing these fires right now. Can you describe what they're like for people who haven't been there and what's so important about them?
Well, they're the jungle. They're lush. I mean, it's hard to take a picture if you're in an intact forest because once you're in it, it's so rich and around you, you can't get any depth to take that picture. You'll hear the life, but you won't usually see it. It's all around you, but it's concealed. But what's amazing about it is the diversity that's within those forests. So we have, you know, more species than you can imagine, more species than we can even count. We don't even know how many are there. So there's this, you know, lush richness of life that is in a tropical forest.
That's Mark Cochran, who's a professor at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
And you can see some photos of forests around the world at hereandnow.org.
I've been thinking a lot about my speed skating mat. It was like a yoga mat, but with blocks at each end, and you put on little booties and skate back and forth. Great workout. Skaters still use them, but I wonder what ever happened to mine. I'm reminded because Peloton, which sells those expensive cycling machines with monthly fees for fitness classes that stream right to onboard screens, is racing toward an initial public offering with a multi-billion dollar valuation. Is this a tech unicorn, the next big thing? Or is it that speed skating mat? For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large at Recode. And Kara, we know Peloton is a phenomenon. People build communities around classes that they stream right there on their bikes. Tell us more.
Well, it's essentially an at-home thing. Think about Jane Fonda, except you have a big device. So what you do is you have this bike, and it's an expensive bike, and they make a lot of money off of selling these bikes. And then when you're at home, instead of going to a gym, or a SoulCycle or wherever, you get on it, and there's all kinds of classes on it, thousands probably by now. And some are live, and some are taped, and you can use your favorite instructor, and you're judged against the other people in the class. So it feels like you're live with people because you have this giant screen in front of you as you pedal.
Yeah. And as you said, it's got a community around it.
Yeah.
And it's got these paid subscriptions to these other classes. So I would imagine lots of revenue off that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting business because it's got two revenue streams, the sale of the device itself, which you need to operate essentially, and then the classes itself. And now they've expanded beyond just bicycling, but other fitness. And there's a whole bunch of companies like this. There's a one that does boxing. There's two that you put on the wall. One's called Mirror. One's called Tonal. And so the idea is it replaces going to a gym, an Equinox or whatever membership. Equinox happens to own SoulCycle.
Right. It replaces real people. It's a virtual relationship. And as John Foley, the chief executive officer and co-founder, writes in their S-1 filing with the SEC, Peloton sells happiness. That's this cult following that we're talking about. I mean, we're reading about people, picking up and traveling several states to be with other Peloton users to have community there. But it's also got competition. It's got people coming out with bikes that are cheaper and the same idea. Yeah. So what's the sense? It's been valued at more than $4 billion privately. What's the sense of its worth going forward?
Well, it's a lot. And a lot of people are sort of trying to compare it to some of these other kind of crazy unicorns like WeWork, that it's way too overvalued. I think setting aside valuation, it's a really interesting recurring revenue business compared to a lot of others. And I think they've got a great brand name and they've got an interesting directional thing they could go around clothes, around all kinds of things. And so everybody's not quite so like that this is sort of a flash in the pan kind of thing, is if they can develop these, because people are moving a lot of their activities online, essentially. And so why not do it for fitness? And if they can sort of make a business out of extending the brand, because not everybody can afford that bike. It's obviously aimed at high-end people. But this idea of a recurring revenue stream that they do really well is a smart one. And so we'll see if that'll continue, if it's worth as much as that. But at the same time, there certainly is a trend towards displacing physical chains with online alternatives. It's not going to completely do it because there's like a boom in all kinds of things like Rumble and Orange Theory and things like that, which are interesting too, that people want to have fitness in a very short amount of time and not sort of hang around at the gym all the time.
Okay, Kara, you got to be my advisor here. Rumble?
Rumble, yeah. Rumble is a thing where you box and bike. There's all kinds of different things coming out. And in that case, you meet with people just like you would with SoulCycle or other places like that.
Right. So what does this tell us about the future, though, of what a former marketing director at Peloton is calling exertainment? Exercise, but it entertains you, engages you, you know, in place. You don't have to, as you say, go to a brick and mortar. It distracts you. Is that the future?
That's a great way to put it, actually. It's sort of like edgemutainment, essentially. There's all kinds of things like that. But it is, you know, it's surprisingly immersive given the screens. And as you get more VR and things like that, it, you know, it could be really interesting that you don't really have to leave your house for a lot of experiences. And so, and it could, you know, like a lot of these things, like you said, I have a whole bunch of exercise equipment I never use anymore, right? You just sort of put it in the back of the basement and that's the end of it. And so the question is, will people, can they keep it as fresh that people keep having an exciting time using it? And that's the real problem with any kind of entertainment, any kind of exercise, is people get tired of it.
Well, as you mentioned, Peloton branching out, they even bought another fitness tech company, Mirror, which sells full-length mirrors that double as screens to broadcast interactive home gym training sessions.
Yeah, that's an interesting company. And so, I mean, imagine someday your entire wall will be an exercise screen and then you feel like you're immersed in a physical place. It's just, it's an interesting trend for sure.
Yeah, but then you can't hug your yoga teacher, Tara.
My yoga teacher is not very huggy, but maybe yours is.
Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode, and we think maybe a member of the cult of Peloton, we're hearing.
A little bit.
Kara, thanks so much.
Thanks. Someone left me one in the house I have, and I use it as a hanger for my clothes right now, but I like it. It's really well done.
That's where they usually end up.
Yeah, exactly.
Kara, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeremy, do you do Peloton?
I don't, but I have a new exercise startup people might be interested in. It's called Outside. It makes you feel like you're outside in nature.
You go
while you're
outside,
running or walking. It's possible.
Patent that. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.